This is Phil Ferrand. And I'm driving home. It's Thursday today. It is episode 134. And it's a beautiful day today. A little cool, but not nearly as cold as it's going to be soon. So I am not complaining. This was our first real kind of snap of cold here in the Ozarks this week. We had been enjoying 70 degree weather, and then all of a sudden it dropped this week. So we'll see. I think we're supposed to warm back up this weekend. That will be lovely. Everything has been puttering along at home. I am working on revisions on Grumpy Old Prophets at this point, and trying to get Grumpy Old Prophets 2 to the point where I feel like, yeah, okay, I'm close enough to beta that I should go ahead and get beta started on Grumpy Old Prophets 1, because I never put that out into beta, so I'm going to do that first. And then while that's in beta, I'll do the rest of the dressing up of Grumpy Old Prophets 2. And we'll go from there. I actually, this week, decided to split Grumpy Old Prophets 2 in half. I'm still going to package it as one book, but as it turned out, it's about 125 pages. And as it turned out, there is an extremely natural dividing line about halfway through. As it also turned out, Grumpy Old Prophets 1 is about 69 pages, and so that would put this dividing line at about the same page count. So Grumpy Old Prophets 2 is actually going to be book 2 and book 3. Just to make this as complicated as possible, there's going to be part 1, which is going to be the Christmas story. And then there's going to be part 2 and part 3, which is the life of Jesus, that'll be bundled as one book. And then there'll be part 4, which is the Easter story. And then it looks like there may be a part 5. I am in the process of making that decision now, but I suspect there will be a part 5, because there are some things I would like to say in part 5, which is the beginning of the church. It's the first little bit of the Acts of the Apostles. There are some things that I would love to say that it might provide me a platform to say them. And the great thing about not being read by anyone is that you can basically say what you want. And you won't get in trouble, because nobody's going to read it anyways. So I'm seriously considering going ahead and doing a part 5 to it. As the book has started to lay out, I've been thinking about titles and trying to figure out how do I make this all mash together and make it feel like there's continuity in it. And I finally decided that the title of Grumpy Old Prophets 2 was going to be Of Wanting and Waiting, because the two parts of the book, the first section of the book is going to be called Wanting, and the second section of the book is going to be called Waiting. So Of Wanting and Waiting. So since I'm doing that, of course, that means that I should really go back and figure out what Grumpy Old Prophets 1, the Christmas story, is supposed to be called. And I think that is called Knowing. And I think the Easter story is called Being. And I think the one from the Acts of the Apostle, the Acts of the Apostles, not the Acts of the Apostles, the Acts of the Apostles will be called Acting, which there will be a reason that will become clear after I start writing the book. So I think this little saga is going to actually end up in 5 parts, not 3, but that's okay. They're short books, they're fairly easy to write, and then we'll get on to other stuff. Speaking of other stuff, I got my Popular Science magazine this month, and it's on big data. The idea of big data, and I may talk about that in the coming weeks. Probably have an episode more or two on this Willpower book. And then I did read another book called Boomerang. I've mentioned that I'm going to talk about a little bit because there's some fascinating stuff in there. And then maybe after that we'll talk about big data a little bit because there's some interesting ramifications to this big data stuff. And it actually gave me some ideas for my big series of books, Realmers, that I will probably write after Grumpy Old Prophets, unless I go back and start working on Amanda and the Skleberry Tree sequels. You know, I'm trying to be smart in life, and everybody really likes Amanda and the Skleberry Tree. I mean, everybody who has read it, well, with the exception of one or two, but, you know, the beta readers all liked it. I've given it to people to read. They're just all, I love this book. They love Amanda and the Skleberry Tree. And sometimes, you know, you don't spit on things that people are liking. So I have to decide. There's probably 5 or 6 or 7 books in that series, and it would take me several years to get to it, and I've just got to try to balance. I don't know. When the time comes, we'll make that decision. Anyways, today, I'm going to keep talking about the book Willpower, Rediscovering the Greatest Human Strength, because there is a lot of really good stuff in this book. And I want to talk about Chapter 8 today, because there was some interesting stuff in Chapter 8 from the perspective of the authors, plural, the authors, sisters, stated religious orientation of agnosticism. The authors in this chapter did feel the need to come out and tell the reader that we both used to be Christians and now we're agnostic. And the reason they felt a need to tell the readers this is because they were brave enough to actually address some issues with regard to self-control and religion, or religious thought. And by the time it's all said and done, you know, they come out and say, well, fact of the matter is, you look at all the statistics and, yeah, I mean, having a sacred overview to your life, having religion in your life does seem to help with self-control. And the more self-control you have, the better the quality of your life is, period. People like to think that you can go out and run around, carouse, do anything you want to do, and just run and run and run and go and go and go, and that's going to make your life great. But while there will be some short-term enjoyment in that, it will eventually tear you up because you're giving vent to the flesh, and if you vent to the flesh will create an environment of failure, and it will destroy you because that's its whole purpose. So anyways, having said that, the title of this chapter is fairly blatant. It is, Did a Higher Power Help Eric Clapton and Mary Carr Stop Drinking? So that's a pretty intriguing title for a chapter. And of course, I thought, oh, let's see what we have to say here. And in the chapter, the authors start talking about Eric Clapton, and he was a huge drinker, alcoholic, drunkard. I mean, he also did drugs at the same time, but drinking was one of his main things. In fact, they quote Eric Clapton, maybe not quote, but they allude to the fact that Eric Clapton, not allude, they quote, whatever, they say that Eric Clapton said, although it's not a direct quote, that the only thing that kept him going when he would get really despondent and depressed and suicidal, the only reason he had to say, no, I want to keep living, is that if he killed himself, he wouldn't be able to drink any longer. Okay, this is a guy who is way deep into the drink. So, when his son was born, he decided, you know, I really need to kind of get my act together. So he goes into a rehab. I think it was someplace he had been before. And he's really struggling, and he's struggling. He's just thinking about drink all the time. He can't, and he's just, we call it the white knuckle club. I mean, he's just holding on for all he's worth. Because in my interpretation, the flesh is just pounding him. Pounding and pounding and pounding him, trying to get him back to drinking. And in fact, he had reformed at one point, and then fell off the wagon, and so this is another time when he's really trying to get straightened around. And he was in his room one night at the rehab center, according to this book, and he just felt like he wasn't going to make it. And he had heard people all through this process talk about surrendering, that you need to surrender. And he had never done that. He said his pride had never allowed him to do that. But he was so desperate that he finally got to the point where he said, okay, that's it. And he actually got down on his knees, he said. And he said, I had no notion who I was talking to. I just know that I had come to the end of my tether. I had nothing left to fight with. Then I remembered what I had heard about surrender, something I thought I would never do. My pride just wouldn't allow it. But I knew that on my own, I wasn't going to make it. So I asked for help, and getting down on my knees, I surrendered. And he said from that moment on, he never felt like he was going to fall off the wagon again. He never felt like he was going to be tempted so sorely that he was going to have to take a drink, even when his son died prematurely. So that's pretty interesting, because here you have someone who has been a drunk for years and 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 years. Fighting it. And then something turns over within him. And he lets go. They talk about a woman named Mary Carr, who had a terrible upbringing. She's a novelist, and I mean, just, you know, mom's trying to stab her, burn her toys. It's a terrible upbringing. Horrible. And her mom, I guess, was an alcoholic. She ended up being an alcoholic and was really struggling with it. She said, my first prayer that I ever offered was basically along the lines of, where the F have you been? But you know, God will take anything. He will start anywhere, and he'll wait as long as he has to wait. And she said, and then her prayers kind of morphed into gimme, gimme, gimme sessions. But at least she was talking to him. And God doesn't care if it's a gimme, gimme, gimme session. At least people are talking to him. But she really wasn't that committed to it. She was just going through the motions. And then there was one time that she was at some sort of reception, and the alcohol was flowing, and she was just in the White Knuckle Club, holding on for all she was worth. And, you know, she had gone into the restroom, and she knew she was in trouble, and she was struggling and struggling and struggling. And so she said she went into a stall and irrationally sank to her knees to pray and said, "Please keep me away from a drink. I know I haven't really been asking, but I really need it. Please, please, please." She didn't know who she's praying to. She doesn't know. But she said that prayer quieted that mental chattering in her mind enough that she was okay. It's very fascinating for people who don't actually believe in a higher power, who don't actually believe, you know, there is a God who loves them and wants to help them and wants to be a part of their life and can speak into their spirit and can empower them in their spirit to overcome. It's very interesting to hear this happening and see that God loves people so much that he's going to reach. I had an incident. This reminded me of an incident. It didn't have to do with alcohol. It was when I was a young man. And it was one of the years when I was in college. And so I had all the normal hormones that a young man has. And I happened to be up in Nebraska working at a retirement center. And the head of the maintenance crew up there, whom I was working for, there was a woman who had come in to talk to him, an older woman, really saucy, wearing a halter top, nice-looking woman. And I could not get her out of my brain. I mean, it was fun. It was just... the flesh was just pounding on me about this woman. I didn't know her from Adam. She didn't know me, but it was just lust bubbling up. And I didn't know what was going on in my brain. All I knew is that this woman had fired something up. And finally, there came a point where I just bowed my head and said, "Oh, Jesus, you have got to help me here. Please, Jesus." And it was like, and it left. Just like that. So anyways, the rest of the chapter is dedicated to sort of giving some offhanded explanations for what might be going on in these things. They talk about AA and the benefits of AA, how that there have been studies done, and AA, which is loosely organized, loosely affiliated. They don't really keep records of who's coming to the meetings and who's not. And the meetings basically consist of nothing more than people sitting around and talking about themselves. They talk about some of the things that might be going on. One of the things that is going on, for sure, is relationship. And that is a huge takeaway, that if you are needing more self-control in your life, relationship can help. People that you know you're going to have to go look at day after day after day. And honestly, a lot of what I feel like I accomplish just getting together with friends and talking to them is not that I have anything really profound and big to say, so much as it is knowing that week after week, we're going to be sitting across from each other and talking about our lives. And just that process of being in relationship helps with self-control. What also seems to help with self-control is just the fact of verbalizing it. You know, the spoken word is, "Hey, my neighbor is coming home. I will wave." He's just getting his mail, and I'm getting ready to get my mail. I'm getting my mail. Anyways, just that process of speaking through it And hearing yourself say it is a really beneficial process. It seems to do something. I mean, if you open up and you tell someone else what you're feeling and why you're feeling it, if it's something that's inspired by flesh, a lot of the times when you start talking about it, you're going to hear yourself talking about it, and then you're going to say, oh, yeah, this doesn't sound so great when I actually say it out loud. When you actually say it out loud, it's like, oh, yeah, it's not good. And that can actually help you gain self-control. So they're talking about those things as well. I'm backing into my garage. But in addition to those things, they do admit in the chapter that religion, having a concept of the sacred in life, that these things really do help. And they go through some of the statistics talking about that people who are religious people typically live longer, they have more satisfying lives, and they said that they very much trace that back to the fact that there is some mechanism at work that seems to be operating. I'm just looking through my notes. Seems to be operating. Oh, I don't have a light anymore in here. I can't see my notes. Seems to be operating such that it helps people. They quote a couple of things that are really interesting. They talk about that when neuroscientists observe people praying or meditating, they see strong activity in two parts of the brain that are also important for self-regulation and control of attention. That's interesting. And they said people who are subliminally exposed to religious words like God or Bible become slower to recognize words associated with temptations like drugs or premarital sex. Quote, it looks as if people come to associate religion with tamping down these temptations. And the one who had this study, he suggested that prayers and meditation rituals are a kind of anaerobic workout for self-control. So that's pretty interesting. They also noted that believers' self-control comes not merely from a fear of God's wrath, but from the system of values they've absorbed, which gives their personal goals an aura of sacredness. In other words, as you're going through life, if you have a system of values that is based on a belief in a higher power. If you have this system of values, you begin to look at your life as more than just slugging it out in the trenches, as more than just a collection of chemical interactions, as more than just a pile of dust and dirt that's going to go back into the earth when you die. You begin to view your actions as having a sacredness about them. And as soon as you do that, it actually helps you with your self-control, which is pretty interesting. Now that the other thing they talked about in the chapter is something that I think Augustine also made mention of. They talked about the concept of bright lines. St. Augustine said, perfect moderation is much harder. I don't know the exact quote. Is much more difficult. Perfect moderation is much more difficult than abstinence. And this is the concept of bright lines. If you say, well, my line is here, I'll only have one drink. Or I'll only sleep with somebody, have a one-night stand once a month. It's much more difficult to moderate that. Because once you have the one drink, then it'll be like, well, okay, I've already had one drink. It's not really going to hurt me that much to have another drink. And they do have this whole other concept of hyperbolic discounting, but you can look it up. That's an interesting concept, too, that the closer you get to a temptation, the more power that temptation has on you. That's why sometimes when I'm watching a movie and a guy's getting hooked up with the wrong person, you know, wrong woman or a woman's getting hooked up with the wrong man, I shout out to the TV, run away. Get out of that room. Do not look at it. Go. Because of this hyperbolic discounting, that the closer you get to a temptation, the harder it is to actually make a real analysis of what that temptation is going to cost you. You start discounting the effects of succumbing to that temptation. And you start thinking it won't be that bad, which, of course, it always turns out bad. Anyways, the concept of bright lines is that it's much easier if you have a bright line, if you have a bright boundary, such as AA proposes. No more drinking, period. And they make it a really close bright line. They just say, don't drink today. It's just don't have a drink today. Don't worry about tomorrow, just not today. Which, that bright line works really well. It's worked well for a lot of people. So the point of this all is that I find it really fascinating that although these psychologists and sociologists and counselors and those who study self-control in many cases would rather that religion didn't have any positive effect, or at least would rather not even discuss religion, would rather keep it all in the scientific domain. The fact is that in this book, they did have to come out and say, do you know what? A lot of people who are doing studies in self-control have given a begrudging respect to the effect of religion on our lives, to the effect of a sacred system within our lives, and how it can positively affect our self-control. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.